With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetäväinen and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our headlines, the Red Cross describes the humanitarian situation in Yemen as, quote, unimaginable horror, saying two-thirds of the population is deprived of basic health care. The South Korean military says North Korea has fired what appear to be multiple rocket launchers amid tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Also, the exit poll for Japan's parliamentary elections shows the ruling coalition has increased its majority in the upper house, winning 76 of the 125 seats. Hello, and welcome. Thank you for joining us. The International Committee of the Red Cross highlights the worsening situation in Yemen, saying mothers and babies there are facing unimaginable horror. The humanitarian organization says two-thirds of the Yemeni population is deprived of basic health care. It urges the world community not to turn a blind eye to the plight of Yemenis, adding that the people there shouldn't be left alone. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has resulted in a dire humanitarian situation. Riyadh's blockade has made the situation even worse, as Yemenis are denied access to badly needed medicines, food, and other basic necessities. UN figures released at the end of 2021 indicated that nearly 380,000 Yemenis had died since the start of the war in 2015. More than two-thirds of them were children under the age of five. Saudi forces have opened fire in a border area of Yemen's Sa'da province in violation of a UN-brokered ceasefire. Yemeni media reports say 17 people have been killed or wounded in the cross-border fire. The wounded people were transferred to a hospital in the city of Razi. Elsewhere in Sa'da, Saudi forces also reportedly shelled Shada'a district, leaving one person dead and seven others injured. These come despite a truce agreed by warring parties in April that has been extended until August. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015 with the aim of reinstalling a friendly regime. Or I should say, reinstating a friendly regime. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed since then. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of thousands of people are performing the final stages of the Hajj pilgrimage in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Earlier, we were joined by two guests to talk about the atmosphere in the city. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
Welcome to the news review section of this news broadcast. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims are performing the final rituals of the Hajj pilgrimage in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. One of these rituals is tawaf, or walking in procession around the Kaaba seven times. Kaaba is the direction Muslims always face while praying. Another ritual is the stoning of the devil, in which pilgrims throw pebbles at a rock symbolizing the Satan. The rituals culminate in Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. On this day, animals are sacrificed to commemorate Prophet Abraham's decision to sacrifice his son in the name of God Almighty. Another essential part of the Hajj pilgrimage is the shaving of the head for men. Women will only cut the tips of their hair. Eid al-Adha is celebrated in Muslim countries around the world, and the date varies by one day in different countries depending on the lunar sightings. Iranians are marking the occasion today. And joining us today is Mahdi Abbasian, our correspondent in Mecca, and Jahangir Mohammad, director for Center for Muslim Affairs in Manchester. So I'm just going to go to Mahdi Abbasian, who is our correspondent in Mecca. We had just lost the connection for a minute there. I've been told that Mahdi is back on the line to give us an update on the situation in Mecca and what the atmosphere is like for the pilgrims over there in the last days before they return home.
I say hello to you, Milad, from the land of revelation. Well, today I accompanied hundreds of thousands of Muslims who walked toward the Jamarat, a place in Mina, in order to perform the stoning of the devil ritual. Now, this place, one of the purposes of Hajj is to recall, while we are in Mina, how a 94-year-old father, Prophet Abraham, brought his 8-year-old son here for sacrifice in order to act based on God's will. Now, today, Muslims carrying stones, they just collected from Muzdalifa or Mash'ar al-Haram, in which they've spent a night in before. They went there and did this ritual, and there are three places in Jamarat, three walls that they throw stones at. These are places that Muslims believe a devil attempted to talk Prophet Abraham out of doing what he was supposed to do, and that's acting based on God's will. Now, it's very interesting. I talked with a pilgrim, and he told me that although you see what you see here is repeating the Prophet Abraham's actions, everything that happens during Hajj has a higher meaning. It's manifestation. It's a manifestation of something higher. And his revelation was very beautiful. He told me that do not see it like this. It's a symbolic act that tells you and teaches you that you need to reject and stone the temptation to disobey God inside yourself. And other things that I have to tell you is that the environment here in Mina is amazing. Different people, different complexions, different nations, they've all gathered here. Now, in Islam, in Quran, we have a verse that says, and hold fast to the rope of God altogether, and be not divided. And that's what exactly you can see here. There's no division. It's all unity. All Muslims pray together five times a day. They go to the holy sites to perform their rituals. They just help out each other. I've seen today I saw a group of African Muslims who were carrying water, bottles of water, cool water, and then distributing them among Muslims who had walked long distances to get to Jamarat. And this cool water is really refreshing. And all you see is that everyone wants to help the other one. If someone is lost, they try to just help him find their tent in Mina, and things such as this. Now, their social class, their color, everything. See, you do not see these things. What you sense is a pure and solemn atmosphere of brotherhood, serenity, and affection. Back to you, dear Mila.
Thank you, Matty. And Jahangir, I'm going to put you both on hold for a few minutes as we're going to go and see what our viewers are saying on the social media platforms. One of our viewers says, Hajj is an opportunity for Muslims coming from all across the world to exchange their experiences, wishes, achievements, and capabilities. Another one of our viewers says that, I hope that the Islamic Ummah will go to Hajj with unity, as in Hajj rituals, avoiding sectarian differences, relying on the many commonalities they have to form a united front against the enemies of Islam and prevent the influence of foreigners and their domination over Muslims. And thirdly, one other viewer says, the rituals of Hajj is my vision for humans, spirituality, humanity, widespread goodwill, dignity, social justice, and human rights and equality. Jahangir, I'm going to go back to you. Can you tell me about their message of Iran's Islamic Revolution leader and how it resonated among pilgrims?
Well, I think the message of unity that Iran preaches is and Ummah is central to the Hajj pilgrimage. And its rituals, you know, it's the annual gathering of the Hajj, and Muslims from all nationalities, from all backgrounds, from all classes, unite at this time in the remembrance of the Almighty, Allah Subhanahu wa Ta'ala, and we recognize our common heritage, Islamically, but also as followers of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and we essentially, it's a time to reconnect with that message of brotherhood, a single brotherhood, no matter what background, united in the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Tawheed, and distancing ourselves from both the enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but also the false idols that people worship today. And there are plenty of those, not least the materialism and the worship of one's desires, which is at the heart of Western liberalism and the Western liberal agenda, which seeks to impose those values on the rest of the world.
Very well. Thank you very much to the both of you, Mahdi Abbasian, joining us from Mecca, and Jahangir Mohammed with his insights, director for the Center of Muslim Affairs in Manchester. Thank you.
The South Korean military claims that North Korea has fired what appeared to be multiple rocket launchers. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the military detected flight trajectories possibly shot from North Korean artillery. It didn't give further details, but said the military is closely monitoring the situation. Tensions run high on the Korean Peninsula, as Pyongyang has carried out a series of missile tests this year. Recently, newly elected South Korean president warned against any provocative behavior by the North. Yoon Suk-yeol also talked about boosting military capabilities in close cooperation with the United States. Pyongyang, however, says its nuclear and missile programs are for self-defense in the face of U.S.-led threats. North Korea has also repeatedly denounced joint military drills between the U.S. and South Korea as invasion rehearsals. Japan's conservative coalition government has increased its majority in the upper house of parliament in Sunday's election. The vote was held 2 days after the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The longest-serving leader of modern Japan was gunned down on Friday during an election campaign in the western city of Nara. Exit polls suggest incumbent PM Fumio Kishida's Liberal Democratic Party and its junior partner, Kameido, won 76 of the 125 seats contested for the upper chamber. The strong showing could help Kishida consolidate his rule. Meanwhile, surveys put voter turnout at over 51%. Final results are due on Monday. The Japanese government has called for a probe into the security loopholes in the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Chief Cabinet Secretary Hirokazu Matsuno says the government has received a report suggesting fault in the security and guard system. Abe was fatally shot while speaking at a campaign event in the western city of Nara on Friday. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to assassinating Abe. The shooter mentioned Abe's alleged ties to a religious organization linked to the bankruptcy of his family. Abe's killing has drawn condemnations from world leaders. Protesters in Sri Lanka say they are not leaving the presidential palace in the capital, Colombo, until the president actually steps down. People are still crowding outside the residence a day after storming it in anger. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and the prime minister have fled with the navy. They say they will resign on Wednesday. Despite that, the chaos is far from over. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation, factors that brought the once relatively rich economy to its knees. Details of a transition of power and the shape-up of the next government are still not clear. Ukraine's deputy prime minister has called on civilians in the Russia-controlled southern region of Kherson to urgently evacuate. Irina Vereshchuk issued the call as the Ukrainian armed forces are preparing a counterattack there. She said the people are asked to leave as the region could come under artillery shelling. She said the people should not turn into human shields. Kherson's authorities say they want to hold a referendum on joining the Russia Federation, but they have not yet set a date. The Kremlin says the future of the region should be determined by its residents. Ukraine lost control of most of the Black Sea region of Kherson, including its eponymous capital, in the first weeks after Russia launched a military offensive on February 24th this year. Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements relating to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland.
The political developments do not change our position on the protocol or the way in which we work with our British counterparts on Northern Ireland. Our position is that we should endeavour to seek solutions on the implementation of the protocol, and that's it.
The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic.
The new prime minister will carry on more or less the same policy as Boris Johnson, with one difference that maybe he would be a bit more honest with British citizen.
Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's your world news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. The super terrorist bid to whitewash the unpardonable crime of the illegal Zionist regime in killing veteran Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Aqile in Jenin, occupied Palestine last May, is nothing but a clumsy attempt by the U.S. on the pretext of so-called investigation to try to deflect attention of the world public opinion from its own complicity in Israel's terrorist activities, says Kayhan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading Crude U.S. Attempt to Absolve Israeli Regime of Abu Aqile's Murder. Here's the details. The super terrorist bid to whitewash the unpardonable crime of the illegal Zionist regime in killing veteran Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Aqile in Jenin-occupied Palestine last May 11th is nothing but a clumsy attempt by the U.S. on the pretext of so-called investigation to try to deflect attention of the world public opinion from its own complicity in the Zionist regime's terrorist activities. Surely, the Americans cannot disapprove eyewitness accounts of the murder in broad daylight of this famous female Palestinian Christian journalist known for her exposure of Israeli regime brutalities. These eyewitness accounts have also been confirmed by investigations led by independent organizations and media outlets, which have concluded that the murderous Israeli troop deliberately aimed his shot at the unprotected part of her head, despite the fact that Shirin Abu Aqile, with a professional camera in her hand, was wearing the bulletproof vest inscribed "Press" in bold letters. Abu Aqile's tragic death, followed by violence at her funeral in the church by Israeli regime troops who attacked aggrieved Christian and Muslim Palestinian people, sent shockwaves across the region, drawing worldwide condemnation. The United Nations and the European Union, among others, despite their awe of the U.S., had to call for a full investigation into what has been described as a deliberate murder in cold blood. It is obvious the U.S. cannot succeed in its crude game in view of its blind and unequivocal support, both financial and political, of the past 7 decades for the Zionist entity. As a matter of fact, the crux of the chronic question of occupied Palestine and prolongation of the plight of the oppressed people is the illogical support of the U.S. and the West for the unabated crimes of the Zionist regime and its frequent acts of terrorism, which have now spread to Syria and Lebanon as well, coupled with blatant threats against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Unfortunately, the UN has turned a blind eye towards these dangerous developments. This shows the hypocrisy of the West, especially of the US, in manipulating the world body, while wrongly claiming to be an advocate of human rights, which it is definitely not, as is evident by Washington's strike of state terrorism around the world, in addition to the organized terrorizing of its own black-skinned citizens of African origin. amazingly, Joe Biden administration from day one of the killing of Shirin Abu Aghla was calling for an investigation, not to determine the identity of the killers, but to give the Zionists a clean chit. This is what Washington has eventually done, with the U.S. State Department recently saying that its security coordinator had concluded Abu Aghla was not targeted but killed by unintentional gunfire from Israeli positions. This type of conclusion is a clear sign that the usurper and the super terrorist supports the terrorist acts of its poodles around the globe, whether in Palestine or in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that will affect the governments, communities, organizations, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the film industry in Pakistan has degenerated owing to the overwhelming influence of Bollywood and Hollywood. And we shall also take a look at the history of cinema in Pakistan, its ebbs and flows, how it lost talent to Bangladesh, and how political tensions with India affected filmmaking.
Pakistan's beleaguered film industry is desperately looking for a fresh lease of life, but the struggle seems to be real. Despite great expectations, the South Asian country's cinema has failed to live up to its massive potential, mostly mimicking Bollywood and Hollywood. Instead of churning out films in line with the country's rich socio-cultural values and traditions, as well as themes people can relate to, the Pakistani cinema industry, known as Lollywood, has settled to being a rehashed version of overseas cinema.
The Pakistani cinema industry, now approaching 75 years of its existence, is still struggling to carve a niche for itself in the global entertainment sector. The reasons are plenty, but analysts mainly point to Lollywood being overshadowed by Bollywood and Hollywood, lack of technology, unimaginative screenwriting, and dwindling number of theaters in the country. The Pakistani film industry has failed to evolve on its own. In order to compete with its international counterparts, Lollywood has lost that Eastern touch to it. A top Pakistani actor, Hamza A. Abbasi, a few years ago lamented the impact that the Indian film industry has had in Pakistan and how filmmakers in Pakistan copy Bollywood.
Well, right now, Indian cinema is hit in Pakistan. And I know I can't do it better than them. I can't make Dabang 3. They have bigger budgets. So we have stories. We don't depend on the masala.
Some Pakistani filmmakers have in the past expressed fears of the Indian film industry smothering the Pakistani cinema and damaging the country's Islamic culture and norms. The fact that some private channels in Pakistan distribute and promote Indian films illegally has also incurred huge losses to Pakistani filmmakers. However, it wasn't like this always. Before the 1980s, Pakistan had a thriving film industry and films didn't copy India or the West. The themes were in line with the country's rich cultural ethos. Then the decline began, followed by the slow death, which gradually opened the floodgates for Bollywood and Hollywood in Pakistan.
We could talk about the uplifting or further developing or improving the declining situation, if we could think about the national solidarity or unanimity or something like that. And then everybody has to talk about, they have their social freedom, maybe their national rights or statutory rights, whatever it is. But again, there has to be a policy for the national identity, for the sake of the national representative, and it's into the media. So this is what we are saying, is that what we can see, that there is a lack of a development. There is no chance of development unless there is some point where a substantiating or sufficient policy making is there.
After the Indian Army's airstrike in a tribal belt of Pakistan in early 2019, which led to heightened tensions between the two strange neighbors, Indian films were quickly pulled out of cinemas in Pakistan. For the past 3 years, Pakistani cinema has struggled to fill the vacuum. To make up for the loss, Pakistani filmmakers have tried to replicate the formula of Indian and Western cinema based on so-called liberal themes. As a result, the new films coming out from Pakistan have faced intense scrutiny for promoting wrong values and culture.
In an indication of how Bollywood and Hollywood have overshadowed Pakistan's ailing film industry, the Muslim-majority country's filmmakers have been trying to use the ingredients of Indian and Western cinema to churn out new Lollywood movies. In India and the U.S., which together account for an overwhelming majority of films produced globally, the so-called liberal themes, promoting vulgarity, immorality, and sleaze, dominate the New Age cinema. Instead of reviving their own traditions and customs through films and creative art, Pakistani filmmakers appear to have fallen into a vicious trap. Former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan had expressed his misgivings over the growing trend of vulgarity dished out by Hollywood Bollywood, laying stress on the cinema that promotes Islamic values and teachings. He even instructed his special assistant to work on a blueprint to revive the country's film industry away from the ominous shadows of Bollywood and Hollywood. However, the juggernaut rolls on.
This is a very well understood that Imran Khan was one of the great politicians in the history of Pakistan. He's still, and no wonder he can come back and take the office. However, he's concerned about the copying Hollywood or Bollywood. It has many many meanings. We could interpret into many directions. For example, Imran Khan was against the production of the blind following of Hollywood or Bollywood, because there are some differences definitely at the national level, at the international level, which that make Pakistani audience as well as the Pakistani media quite identical as compared to the other film industries, for example, Bollywood or Hollywood. They have their own standards, they have their own policies, they have their own ways and methods, and they have their own cultures and ethnic standards, maybe, whatever. But that's Imran Khan's meaning was that Pakistani film industry has to develop its own identity into the into this competitive profession.
More recently, a Pakistani film, Joyland, which became the country's first ever entry at the Cannes Film Festival, appeared to glorify the transgender culture, much to the chagrin of Pakistan's majority Muslim population and clergy. The controversial film has rekindled the debate over the decay of Pakistani cinema.
The partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, besides spawning the worst humanitarian disaster, tremendously altered the landscape of film industries in the two countries. While India lost some great talent, Pakistan had to build the industry from scratch. With a strong foundation, the Indian film industry took giant strides over the years. Pakistani cinema, on the other hand, took smaller but measured steps. Quite remarkably, though, political tensions between the two countries had a ripple effect on their respective cinemas, too.
Following the partition of British India in 1947, filmmaking in the newly founded Pakistan suffered due to a lack of equipment and talent, as most noted artists and directors moved to India. In India, big cities such as Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras emerged as cinema hubs, but Pakistan only had Lahore as the major film center. The two major studios in the city were destroyed in the post-partition riots, leaving Pakistan's film industry without proper funding or specialized infrastructure.
From the partition in the year of 1947, we can see is that there was no, not any infrastructure available for Pakistan at national level to make films. So it took them 3 years to make a complete mechanism or a system to make movies. And then from 1950 all the way down to the late 70s, they made pretty good hits. You could say they were the good blockbusters. Even the neighboring countries they were following, and there have been at least 8 movies that have been made following by Pakistani cinema. The Pakistani cinema produced it, and they were remade into the Bollywood movies. At least 8, right? So till late 70s, the industry was flourishing. The people were performing, and the industry was growing, but because of the General Zia's regime, who took the power, and as an army general who brought the martial law into effect, there came a complete halt into the any production of film industry because of his so-called Islamization.
Years after the independence, there was an attempt to ban Indian films in Pakistan to help the local film industry gain foothold and flourish. It didn't happen until 1965, when the second war between the two estranged neighbors prompted then-Pakistani military general Mohammad Ayub Khan to ban Indian films. More than 40 years later, in 2005, another military ruler, General Parvez Musharraf, lifted the ban. In 2019, India accused Pakistan of orchestrating a terrorist attack in Kashmir's Pulwama, which was followed by India's surgical strike inside Pakistan. It led to the reinstatement of the ban on Indian films in Pakistan. To fill the vacuum, Pakistani filmmakers quite imprudently started copying Bollywood, even at the risk of losing their own substance.
Comparatively, Pakistan and India are in the similar situation like England and America, with the same languages. England today can never make an Indiana Jones, but England still makes a Shakespeare in Love and get recognized. So we have the same chance. We will not be able to make a Dabang 2, but we will be able to make a Shakespeare in Love in the future.
Pakistan's film industry had a purple patch in the 1960s and 70s when around 170 movies were produced annually, including color films. The number has nosedived to less than 20 a year now. Many experts attribute the downfall to the separation of East Pakistan, which later came to be known as Bangladesh, in March 1971. Bengali actors and directors were instrumental in the development of Pakistan's cinema. Apart from losing creative people and skilled technicians, the film industry in Pakistan was also deprived of a big market and production center.
The 1960s, which is widely regarded as the golden period of Pakistani cinema, recorded an impressive growth of films and film stars. During this period, the country's film industry opened up to local and international markets, reaping great dividends.
Today's filmmakers, since they're starting from scratch, they don't have any continuity with the old filmmakers, they're in a conflict. They don't know exactly what a good film these days would be in Pakistan. Should it be the old-fashioned social drama with lots of masala and songs? Should it be just a comedy to distract people from what's happening in Pakistan? Or should it be a comment, a pointed comment on what's happening in Pakistan? So they're still searching exactly for the right formula. And it'll come. It'll come.
In 1971, almost 400 cinemas functioned across the country, a quarter of them in East Pakistan. A year before, 114 films alone were produced in what later came to be known as Bangladesh. The separation of East Pakistan in 1971 dealt a heavy blow to Pakistan's flourishing film industry. It took decades for it to recover, only to fall into the Bollywood trap. The cinema industry in Bangladesh also had to start from scratch. It did well in the beginning, but faced similar hurdles as Pakistan did after the 1947 partition. Over the past five decades, it has struggled for survival, prompting Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina in March this year to allocate a special fund for the revival of the country's film industry.
First of all, the government has to allocate some financial budget, substantiating monetary support. This is the first thing. Second thing is they have to work for bringing in the latest technology into the industry, and then they have to introduce the well-qualified people, the directors and actors and whosoever takes it, the scriptwriters, the storytellers, the plot setters, whatever it takes. They have to. We have to bring in the technology, like a computer, the graphic designers, the animators. It has to be a lot to bring everything together. And then what another important thing is that there has to be competitive benefits, the remuneration for the actors, the great, the talented people, so they can come, they, instead of going abroad and performing for other places, if they have great benefits right there in their, at their home ground, definitely it will make a huge difference.
Experts, however, have cautioned Bengali filmmakers not to fall into the Bollywood trap like Pakistan and risk losing its essence. For both neighbors, the mantra of success lies in charting their own journeys independent of Bollywood and Hollywood.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Now, let's begin with, why has Pakistan's film industry failed to live up to its potential despite its artistic talent, intelligence audience, and ample resources?
It's a huge historical perspective behind that.
In fact, Pakistan film industry, my elder brothers were involved in film industry. I know very well. I know those directors, those who were well-renowned as well, and they made some remarkable films as well. One, apart from my brother and his colleagues, I know one known as Zia Sarhadi. He was born in India, but settled in Pakistan. Then later he had to leave Pakistan because of his talent. In fact, his write-ups and his films as well, because of the martial law and dictators and all that. So similar story are like, for example, those who survived within Pakistan, they made some good film, feature film, but not very politically. If you touch political topics, then it's a problem. That's a basic issue of Pakistan industry falling up. Also, especially, I won't go far behind, but since 80s, when Ziaulhaq, the dictator who came in power, and during his era, the worst thing has happened because there was no Netflix or no digital options available at that time. Only cinemas were available. When you don't have any cinemas, or when you don't have any films coming in with the good write-ups or good direction or good actors, and the topics are not relevant to the reality, so the industry went down. And I saw many things. I spoke to many people about this topic as well, some actors and all that. The thing is, when Pakistan came into existence or Partition happened, many of the writers, directors, actors of that time, they are still icons, whether Riaz Shah, Iqbal Akhtar, whether Zia Sarhadi, or many others, actors Santosh, or you name it, so many were there. And they were making good films, and they were having good attraction for Indian market at that time. Even after that, another era came up during those, when the big screen was summed up. Then the television screen, Pakistan television dramas were of way above than even Bollywood, the Bombay film industry, and they were even copying or following the songs and also the theme and also the stories in the films. That was the aspect. I was part of the South Asian television phenomena, which we brought into Europe. And at that time, the biggest attraction was Pakistan television dramas and writers. So we had the good writers, we had the good talent, but the political scenario was against these things. And also extremism came up. Also the Afghan jihad, so-called, came up, and the mullah fanatics came up, and they wanted to close down everything which could have changed the society. So that was a major reason behind Pakistani film industry to go down.
Sir, former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan was a vocal critic of a Bollywoodization of the Pakistani film industry, which he blamed for promoting vulgarity and immorality. Now, do you think this concerns or his concerns were legitimate?
I don't take it 100%. The thing is, to support those fanatics or those close-mindedness or those people, those who were against these phenomena, to have their support, one has to address their issues in their way. So he was addressing, whereas he was very much known as a progressive and liberal person living in Western, but his reaction was not because he wanted to have those things. Those things will never change. The thing is, vulgarity is not because of vulgarity, is because other means, other problem. Despite in Pakistan there are so many political Islamic organizations, but Pakistan society is deteriorating badly because of not having openness, not having proper knowledge or education. So they're not addressing the right issues. But these issues related with vulgarity or whatever Imran has said or he promoted, I think they were just to have the edge on political side from those people, those who are in fact controlling Pakistan, not majority, but they are controlling through establishment and all that. So it was just to promote their ideas, not to address the right issues. That's how I take it.
Last but not least, sir, what does the future hold for Lollywood, and how can it reclaim its lost glory?
Well, there's no doubt that we have wonderful writers. My personal friends, I'm a journalist, I'm into media, I'm in television, my family was in film, I'm part co-producer of this film, and also I'm engaged with many of the filmmakers and directors from Lollywood and Bollywood as well. for Pakistan, India, and other places, Bangladesh as well. But I do find it's difficult, even if we can make some film like Gulmakai, we cannot show it in Pakistan. We cannot address those issues which are good for the society. We cannot address those unless they make it okay. They are this establishment, unfortunately, holding not only politics, they are holding media, they are holding every aspect. You cannot get out of those things unless they agree to you. If they agree to anything, you can do everything. If they disagree to anything which is good, you cannot do anything. So unless those controls are not fading away, we'll not be able to grow or come out of this effect of Bollywood or even westernized film concepts. We have our own local concept and topics which we can address, and we can make good dramas, good films, good everything. But we are not there because of these unwanted controls.
There you have it, Mr. Shahid Khan, senior investigative journalist and documentary producer from London, UK. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Pakistani broadcast journalist Shifa Yousafzai cites former Premier Imran Khan as saying that Bollywood movies promote vulgarity and sexual abuse in Pakistan, which are not part of the country's culture. Mehwish Hayat, a Pakistani film and TV actress, says it's time for Pakistan's cinema industry to step up and counter the way it is shown in Hollywood and Bollywood, adding that they need films about Pakistan. A Pakistani-Canadian software developer, Harris Ahmed, writes to Pakistani actor and singer Ali Zafar, expressing hope that Pakistani cinema will create its own amazing genre, away from Bollywood and Hollywood. A Twitter user by the name Gustavo stresses that Pakistani cinema is on decline, adding that copy-pasting Bollywood is not working. Ikram Hussain, a Pakistani political activist, says the country must ban Bollywood and that local artists should be given incentives so that they promote their civilization.
And that was our episode about the downfall of Pakistan's film industry due to the unhealthy influence of Indian and Western cinema. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
Criticism from the charity's food policy director came in response to a new United Nations report revealing that around 1 in 10 people worldwide went hungry last year. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Broken Capitalist Food System Drives Soaring Global Hunger, Oxfam says. Stay tuned for more. Around 1 in 10 people went hungry last year in a world losing ground on its collective goal of ending all forms of hunger, a report released recently by United Nations agencies revealed, prompting sharp censure from a leading charity. As many as 828 million people experienced hunger in 2021. 150 million more than were affected just 2 years earlier, according to the latest State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World report, that is SOFI. The paper, a joint publication of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD,
The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, and the World Health Organization, WHO, cited conflicts, climate-driven extreme weather events, and economic shocks as primary causes of hunger. The report also found that nearly 1 in 3 people worldwide last year were moderately or severely food insecure, meaning they lacked reliable access to enough affordable, nutritious food. It is deeply concerning that global hunger has been spiraling since 2019 and is now at such devastating levels around the world. Hanna Saarinen, Oxfam International's food policy head, said in response to the report. Saarinen continued, "This is happening not because of a shortage of food, but rather as a consequence of a broken food system further undermined by conflicts, the effects of the COVID pandemic, and worsening climate change. Despite this being a global food crisis, seeing millions of people going hungry today, food billionaires' wealth has reached a stratospheric levels, increasing by $382 billion just over the last 2 years," she added. "Our food system has for years perpetuated inequality, impoverished the small-scale farmers, and pushed millions of vulnerable people into hunger while wreaking havoc on the climate," she said. Saarinen said that while it is easy to blame today's food crisis on the crisis in Eastern Europe that began in February, long-standing political failure to address how we feed all the people in the world has made our food system susceptible.